psychoanalysis has so much to offer a particular patient population that really doesn't have sufficient access to our psychoanalytic work and applications. It's a terrible pity because so many of them really benefit from it directly, and there's so much benefit for society in general.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This is a podcast in which we will discover the world of psychoanalysis that lives beyond the couch, beyond the individual consultation room. We will meet psychoanalysts who work in dialysis units, prenatal clinics, corporate boardrooms, community centers, humanitarian organizations, and with vineyard workers, just to name a few. We hope these conversations expand our awareness of how broadly psychoanalytic thinking extends into our communities. Come listen, enjoy, and please share your comments on the webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz. I'm a psychoanalyst on the faculty of the Psychoanalytic Association of New York and the Psychoanalytic Center of Philadelphia. My guest today is Dr. Corinne Min. Dr. Min is a psychoanalyst at the British Society and a fellow of the Royal College of Psychiatrists. She trained as a forensic psychiatrist and psychotherapist, bringing these specialties together in her post as consultant psychiatrist at the Portman Clinic and at Broadmoor Hospital. She is president of the International Association for Forensic Psychotherapy and chairs the IPA in the Community Committee on Violence. Her focus for the past 25 years has been mainly on providing psychoanalytic treatments for patients who have acted violently or are troubled by sexual perversions. Many of her patients are in secure settings, psychiatric hospitals or prisons, where psychoanalytically informed supervisions are provided to the staff, given the strength of these reactions these patients or prisoners can provoke in those caring for them. Long-term, in-depth work is an important part of the overall treatment for such multiply traumatized people, given their background histories, the offenses they commit, and their discovery during treatment of being mentally disordered. Strong resistances to this work are regularly encountered, particularly by a general public that can mistake understanding with condoning. However, providing psychoanalytic approaches within relevant mental health and criminal justice organizations is often appreciated. I invite the listeners to this interview to consider the question of what it would be like to work intensively with individuals over the course of years, individuals who have committed heinous crimes. What does it take for each of us to separate understanding from condoning? I learned a great deal in my interview just on that subject alone. Here is my talk with Dr. Corinne Min. Corinne, welcome to the podcast. As you know, psychoanalysts generally do not recommend a depth and uncovering treatment for patients with a history of extreme violence, not to mention murder. And we know that the thinking behind this is that the most disturbed states of minds that patients have experienced in their lives often reemerge in the treatment setting between themselves and their therapists and analysts. And given that, it is felt that an uncovering approach that allows those primitive states of mind to emerge is not in the best interest of either the patient nor often of the therapist or analyst. And yet your work has demonstrated, as I read it, through your thoughtfulness and, I must say, remarkable fortitude, as well as working with a very strong and experienced team, your uncovering interventions have allowed these primitive states of minds to emerge in ways that do benefit the individual. And your approach has led to significant changes in their lives, and as a result of that, in the lives of their family members, as well as the caretakers, whether it be in a hospital or a prison. Please introduce us to these individuals. Tell us about who they are, what their pasts have been, what their crimes were, what you've learned about their states of mind, and what kind of interventions you're able to make both verbally and also by your presence, and how all that has contributed to meaningful change in the lives of many of them.
Thank you, Harvey, for asking me to address such an interesting, broad, and important question. Of course, from my perspective, psychoanalysis has so much to offer a particular patient population that really doesn't have sufficient access to our psychoanalytic work and applications. And it's a terrible pity because so many of them really benefit from it directly. And there's so much benefit for society in general from the application of psychoanalytic work with what maybe I can refer to as those mentally disordered offenders, MDOs. This is how they tend to be referred to as. But as with many things in the crossover between the criminal justice system and mental health settings, i.e. forensic psychiatry settings, there's a tendency to use terms which can contribute to the dehumanizing. And there aren't very many of us working psychoanalytically with these kinds of patients, but those of us who do are very impressed by what psychoanalysis can contribute. Now, the kinds of people that we see, well, there are a broad range of people. They're people who have one thing in common. And the thing that they have in common is that their babyhoods, in fact, for some of them, their period of 9 months in utero was already a disturbed time. Their babyhoods, toddlerhoods, and childhoods were absolutely full of traumatic situations that can only lead to necessary mental, psychological adaptations for them to be able to survive. So what we have is a group of patients who've developed what is generally referred to as maladaptive responses. But actually, I don't like the use of the term maladaptive. I actually think that these responses, they're acting out, they're violent acting out, or their delinquency, or the sexual perversion that they might have developed. I actually consider these highly adaptive responses to the most extraordinarily traumatic upbringings that are sometimes unimaginable. So that's really what all these diverse patients would have in common. In my 30 years working with the so-called mentally disordered offenders, that is the common denominator. However, if one takes the time to work analytically and in depth over a long period of time with a patient from this grouping, one then discovers that each person's response to what happened to them is very, very particular to them and very individual. So my colleagues and I, we tend to work in a number of different settings, which are far removed from the usual psychoanalytic setting of a consulting room with a couch, seeing the person 3 or 4, 5 times a week, lying on a couch. What we do is we go to different levels of secure mental health institutions, from high security to medium security to low security, and we see patients in the community. Some of us also have some regular sessions in different prisons. Sometimes we just go to prisons to do assessments for trials in the hope of airlifting somebody out of the prison sector into the hospital sector. And the difficulty, I mean, there are innumerable resistances, psychoanalytic and indeed societal, that we're faced with in trying to apply psychoanalytic work to this patient population. And the most obvious one, of course, is society's general response to patients who have committed crimes, a wish for punishment, retribution, and lock them up. And the more abhorrent the crime, the more potent is the response for a punishment. And we actually think that the treatment should fit the crime, not the punishment should fit the crime.
Let me ask you about that. I know what you mean, because in reading some of your papers and encountering these individuals, I experienced the abhorrence you were just attributing to society. I felt a repugnance for them. And that was even in the face of how deeply you humanize them in understanding their past and how their minds worked. But I'm assuming I'm not a worse person than others, and that you too must know that repugnance. I mean, before you've gone beyond it, before you've thought of them as individuals who are suffering and therefore have every right to have their lives improved if we know how to do that, have you yourself also known that repugnance when you hear some of the horrendous things they've done?
Absolutely. And I have to express my gratitude to my supervisor, the late Dr. Leslie Sohn. I had the privilege of being supervised by him for over 25 years. And it was really thanks to him that I was able to work with that fear, the disgust, the repugnance for what these kinds of patients have done, and separate that from fear and disgust for them. So it was very important for me to distinguish hating what they did, but not hating them. I think what has also helped, apart from the essential supervision over the years, has been getting to know the patients. If you offer yourself as a listening and attempting to understand psychoanalyst with someone who's done something abhorrent, and you gradually get to know something of why they ended up doing what they did, and enabling them to understand why they might have ended up doing what they did, on the background of getting to know their own history, which had numerous ingredients in it that has led to that, then it enables you to be in a room with somebody who's done something abhorrent and still have a nanogram of compassion, which can allow a therapeutic rapport to gradually build up. And of course, because of their own experiences with others, including quite often their primary object, it is very difficult for them to accept, you know, that you might be trustworthy, that you're there to help. And the work in the high security hospital, for example, when I approach a patient that maybe a clinical team is keen for the psychoanalyst to get involved with, I would go and meet the patient on the ward, and I would be promptly told, fuck off. I would return the following week, and I'd be told the same thing, fuck off with your psychobabble. And this might go on for several weeks, sometimes a couple of months, but I insist on keeping going at the same time every week until they actually start getting a bit curious about my curiosity and them. 100% of the time, I eventually have a patient in a room twice a week for 50 minutes.
That's quite something. As I'm picturing what you're describing, what comes to my mind immediately is your reference to the patients. These are male, and you're obviously a woman. That must be front and center, something that has to be acknowledged and dealt with.
I like your description, front and center. You know, the irony is that in the earlier years, I worked with women patients as well as with men, and I found, paradoxically, the women patients much more difficult to work with. And I don't know whether it had something to do with the immediacy of the envious dynamic. Here's a woman coming in to see me who was able to have her hair cut a couple of days ago, who's got her makeup on, who's coming to see me, and I'm stuck in this godforsaken hospital, and who does she think she is? Whereas with the men, there's a different thing that arises from the beginning. I think the gender difference, paradoxically, is, I find, helpful. It's also helped me a lot of the time to be working in England with an Irish accent, because I can't immediately be located as working class, middle class, or upper class. Obviously, I'm a white Irish woman. But the fact that I am Irish, I think, has a weird extra dimension to enable me to make a rapport, perhaps more swiftly, with patients who feel that they come from oppressed societies or communities, and they maybe have they imagine, you know, that I, as an Irish woman, must have had it a bit hard myself, you know, coming over to England and being accepted. Of course, this is not something that we ever talk about, but they might raise it. You know, for example, it's very sad to have to say that a lot of the young gang men that I work with, the ones who are involved in street gangs and postcode wars and so on, who end up serving quite long sentences in prison, the fact of me being Irish, with most of them being black, helps enormously. On innumerable occasions, some of them have said to me, "Oh no, you're okay, because you must remember those posters in England. Right up, my granny remembers them in the 1980s. No blacks, no Irish, no dogs." So it gives me a kind of a hood pass.
Right. You've described in your writings, which will be noted on the notes in the podcast, that you at times feel your mind taken over by these individuals. Can you share with us what that experience is like and how you've come to understand it and use it in service of being of help to them?
I think in order to be able to make progress with the psychoanalytic treatment with these patients, it's very similar to working with less obviously disturbed patients who maybe have not acted out so violently, in that one has to be emotionally engaged in the process. So what comes to mind is one young man who killed his mother. And at the beginning, he found it very difficult to be in the room with me. He was still using a lot of manic defenses, clowning around, jumping around in order to avoid any seriousness. And I kept interpreting to him his avoidance of seriousness, given that we were actually in this room together twice a week in a high security hospital because he had killed his mother. And very gradually, he was able to start allowing himself the broader affective repertoire without needing to bring up all these manic defenses. But one of the difficulties was that we overshot the runway together. So he made amazing progress. He got appropriately depressed. He got very, very into very guilty states, including being able to start saying how guilty he felt that he was the one who had killed his mother, and his brother, who had not killed their mother, was out there in the community struggling, and here he was getting all this wonderful treatment, and yet he was the one who'd done the killing. So this further progressed into him developing a transference delusion that his mother wasn't dead. "There she was," he said, pointing to me. So this took an incredible amount of work to then get through that. And it entailed him having to have yet another depressive breakdown whilst in the high security hospital. And eventually this young man actually did progress and graduate to medium security and low security, and he's now living in the community, has a decent job and a decent relationship. But when he first got out into the community, he was still coming for his psychotherapy sessions to see me. And he started yet another development, which was, okay, doctor, please, forget you, doctor, me, patient. What do you, as a woman, think of me as a man? And then it gradually emerged that he had developed real loving feelings towards me, and he thought he was in love with me. And this again took several months of work, and I'm so grateful to Leslie Song, you know, for helping me think this through with him. What emerged was that he had experienced real, consistent, long-term, loving feelings for someone for the first time, but that these had become sexualized. So when he came for his sessions, he noticed himself getting erections, and he thought this meant being in love with me, and he wanted to know if this was reciprocal and so on. But when we worked on that and looked at that and examined it together, what it actually boiled down to was that this boy who had been so neglected and so not cherished in his babyhood, what he really wanted was to come and sit in my lap and for me to make some soothing maternal sounds to him. And it was as if he had developed loving feelings, but he didn't quite know what to do with them. And it was very moving, but we got there in the end. And I'm pleased to say he's now got a very nice girlfriend and is managing well in the community. But I'm reminded of one of your podcasts with a wonderful Israeli psychoanalyst who's done the work on psychodialysis. And I would like to refer to that because the work that we do with these patients whilst they're in secure settings, be it prison or high security psychiatric hospitals, it has to be long term. And the ongoing work when they're eventually back in the community is a form of psychodialysis. It's long term maintenance, psychoanalytic work, which is nevertheless cost effective, I hasten to add, because we have to think about budgets and all of that with our mental health settings and the Department of Health and so on. It's nevertheless very cost effective because it keeps people out of high secure hospital, which actually costs over £300,000 per annum, and it keeps them out of prison, which is on average £50,000 per annum. And, you know, to see me once or twice a week is less than £10,000 per annum in our National Health Service.
Let me ask you a question about that case you just described for us. But for your reference to the fact that he killed his mother, what you describe is not unfamiliar to analysts around the world. You have a person who, let's just say for the moment, had fantasies of killing his mother, which we're very accustomed to, and the struggles with acknowledging that, the struggles with understanding the defensive character one builds so that one doesn't know that, the acting out as a defense against that, the conflict over his wish to sit on your lap to be mothered as a baby, and his wish to be in physical contact with you as an erotic man. Everything about what you've just described, but for the act of killing, is familiar. So that shines a light for me on that issue of why do they kill? Referring to other podcasts, we've spoken with people who work with patients who have addictions, who have psychosomatic conditions, all of which have histories, maybe not as dramatically horrendous as some of your patients, but certainly terribly painful histories. Do you have any reflections on why they acted out the murder as opposed to imagined it?
It's a kind of the million-dollar psychoanalytic question, isn't it? Why do some patients kill when others only think about it? You know, the rest of us just think about it, but these poor people actually end up doing it. So for whatever reason, with their really very damaged mental structures dating back to damage done in the very early relationship to the primary object, the need to project what's going on cannot be kept in mind, and it spills out of the mind into muscularity. And this, I mean, the real tragedy, of course, is that this is a solution to terrible mental distress at a given moment. From my experience, most of these killings could just as easily have been suicides or another kind of homicide. You know, it's a displaceable thing. But at that moment, for a number of ingredients coming together, you know, it would be very different for each individual case why the killing happened at that particular time. But when we get the opportunity to go on a psychoanalytic archaeological dig, we can usually find the background template for this potential of a killing and the catalyst and then the trigger.
I know you're not set up for this, but do you have reflections on the biology that might be involved? There are many people who study patients like this with all kinds of PET scans and MRIs and esoteric blood studies. Do you have any reason to think or reflections that that may be a contributing difference?
Oh, I have no doubt that we need to know and examine much more about the neuroscientific aspects to this, because, you know, if I think, for example, some of the young gang guys, they have severely reduced impulse control. They have no capacity to identify affects, never mind know what's going on at the time. They can't distinguish between excitement and fear. And I think that there is damage probably in that whole hippocampus, amygdala area. And this is definitely something that has to be taken into consideration, because it links with what can psychoanalysis offer. And the reasons why a psychodialysis, to use that lovely term, is necessary, because we can treat these patients, but we can't cure them. And if you have killed somebody, this is something that you have to live with for the rest of your life. And it's an extra identity that you have to take on and absorb in yourself. It's another self that one has to take on. And it is a very difficult one to do, especially when they get well enough to be able to experience what we would refer to as empathy or remorse.
Do you find that medications are useful in, for example, helping that impulse control develop?
Absolutely. Absolutely. One of the great ironies of working in the high security hospital was that Dr. Son and I used to go around prescribing small doses of antipsychotic medication to the so-described personality disordered patients. What we found was that it would actually sedate their more psychotic anxieties and enable them to engage in treatment, and therefore a therapeutic rapport that could build up.
Yes, I've noticed while not working with patients, as you're describing, exactly the same thing, that the judicious use of those medicines as well as the mood stabilizers can often help patients then engage in an affectively meaningful therapeutic and indeed analytic exchange and experience. What you're doing is very unusual. I don't have to tell you that. And can you share with us something about yourself? What brings you to this work?
I don't know how far back to go with that question. I don't know whether growing up as a foreigner in Northern Ireland during the Troubles contributed in some way. Certainly as a child growing up who didn't belong to either of the two communities at war with one another, I remember being very puzzled as to why, when I went to a particular playground, the other kids stoned me and my friends out of that playground. I also was aware, of course, of bombs going off and people being murdered, and being really interested, intrigued, puzzled, as well as upset by all of these things. So I don't know whether that stayed in the background. When I did medicine, I was really very taken by the subject of psychiatry and knew that that's what I wanted to go and specialize in. And then when I went to train as a junior psychiatrist at the Maudsley Hospital in London, I noticed that I was actually getting interested in the patients that nobody else seem to be particularly interested in or got irritated by the revolving door patient who kept turning up at our psychiatric A&E or emergency room, I think you might refer to it as. And in the last bits of my junior psychiatry training, I had the privilege of doing a forensic psychiatry placement with Professor John Gunn, Professor Pamela Taylor and Dr. Paul Bowden, and the wonderful Dr. Jim McKeith. And I, for the first time, had access to these kinds of patients where it was just incredible, the kinds of histories that they had, and you wondered how they could possibly have survived. And here they were in these settings where we could actually work with them over many years. And it just seemed to me so much more satisfying than working on other wards where we didn't get access to the patients for so long. And at the same time, I was exposed to the psychotherapy department with Michael Feldman and Jonathan Pedder and others. And I just thought, wow, surely there must be some way of bringing these two specialties together. And by coincidence, at the time, a new organization was being set up. This was in 1992, steered by Dr. Estella Weldon, who was a psychiatrist and group analyst at the Portman Clinic for many years. And she, with some international colleagues, set up the International Association for Forensic Psychotherapy. In other words, psychoanalytic psychotherapy, working with these kinds of patients. And I have the honor of being the president of that association at the moment. And we were very fortunate to be able to launch issue one, volume one of our new International Journal of Forensic Psychotherapy at the IPA Congress in London just July, a couple of months ago. So things came together at the right time for me. Economically in the 90s, it was also a very good time for NHS developments. And I managed to get created a post in psychiatry, this forensic psychotherapy psychiatry, in the High Secure Hospital and the Portman NHS Clinic, which is for outpatients. And that really enabled me to get access to a lot of patients over the years and to actually see the benefits of taking them on for at least a decade and be able to write up the cost effectiveness of this for the NHS funders.
I'm always interested in what it is you feel that being a psychoanalyst, how that helps you in your work with this or any population. And you've answered the question generally, but let me ask it directly for you. What is it about your having had your own psychoanalysis, having worked with patients in the traditional setting? What about that background gives you a special something when you work with these kinds of patients?
I think that the psychoanalytic training absolutely enriched my psychiatric training, and especially working with these kinds of patients, because it helped me to be with someone in a room. Or, you know, quite often, you know, I end up seeing patients through a little hatch, you know, if they're occluded. So I might only see their eyes. And it enabled me to carry on being able to think when under fire and perhaps sometimes stumble across an interpretation that can have some meaning to the patient. I mean, there's one example that just comes to mind. I remember starting to see an 18-year-old, a boy, who had been transferred from prison to our hospital, and he had been segregated for the previous 2.5 years. He'd been in prison since the age of 14, since a very serious stabbing incident. And every time the prison officers tried to take him out of being locked up in a cell, he would lash out violently, and he'd seriously injured two prison officers and one prison teacher. And eventually at 18, he was transferred to our high security hospital. So he was in the seclusion room of our high security hospital. He was basically mute, but he nevertheless came up to the hatch on the third time that I went up to try and make a communication with him. And all he could say was, I want to kill. And then he would show me the slashing of the neck of what he wanted to do. And at one point, I just said to him, I think you can really only imagine another life for yourself if you take someone else's life and actually even drink their blood in, because he'd been describing the slashing of the neck and drinking the blood of the person. And he was just utterly preoccupied by this. And when I made the interpretation to him, his eyes popped open. And from then on, I had a patient in treatment for 50 minutes, twice a week. Actually, he's still in treatment and he's graduating to medium security very soon. So to come back to your question, I think without the psychoanalytic treatment, I don't think I would have known to come out with that attempted way to understand him. I would have not been able to think beyond the fact that he was showing me the slashing of the neck and the drinking of the blood. So it enabled me to make such an interpretation. But actually, the best teachers are the patients, because I think that interpretation came to me because another patient once said to me, when we were addressing the killing that he had done, he said, well, I didn't have a life, so I had to take someone else's. And I thought, wow, that is so insightful. So a lot of the learning has been from the patient.
Forgive me if what I'm about to say is awkward for you, but allow me. You mentioned that it's an honor for you to be the president of the Forensic Psychotherapy Organization, and I'm sure it is. It is also an honor for me and for the listeners to learn about your work, to learn about your immersion in caring for people who otherwise do not engender caring from anyone else. And I thank you for sharing your work and your spirit and your love with me and the community who are going to listen and learn from this.
Thank you very much, Harvey.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.